From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. 2 million people infected in 2 weeks. That's how fast the coronavirus is blitzing through the U.S. population. And in many states around the country, strict new measures are in place to try to stop the spread. We're going to check in on a few hotspots right now.
A 3-week ban on outdoor dining goes into effect tonight here in Los Angeles County, and the Board of Supervisors is considering another stay-at-home order. Joining us now is Jackie Fortier, a health reporter with KPCC in L.A. And Jackie, what is the situation with the rise in cases here in L.A.?
I mean, we're experiencing a huge surge in new coronavirus cases across California, but like you said, particularly in LA. Over the last week, we've broken daily case records multiple times. Health officials reported nearly 6,200 cases just yesterday. Hospital beds are filling up. And now, unfortunately, we're seeing deaths really begin to rise. Over the last week, on average, 28 people are reported dead every day.
Wow, Jackie. I want to also ask you about some of the bans that are now going into effect. This outdoor dining ban was nearly overturned yesterday in a really close vote, 3-2. Tell us a little bit about that.
California has a color-coded reopening system based on COVID infection rates. And since that was implemented by Governor Gavin Newsom over the summer, LA has always been in the strictest tier because we have been a hot spot. So indoor dining has not been allowed for months, but outdoor dining has. And now that we're seeing this new surge in cases, LA County health officials decided to close outdoor dining for at least 3 weeks and restrict restaurants to takeout and delivery only. Yesterday, the LA Board of Supervisors had a very long, spirited discussion about it after hearing from restaurant owners who say that it would just devastate the industry, and now there's no federal funding to help them out. The board eventually voted in favor after health officials said that it's been clear that people are just going to restaurants with folks outside of their immediate families, you know, taking their masks off to eat and therefore increasing the risk of new infections. So that ban will go into effect tonight at 10.
And there's also talk of the stay-at-home order being floated. With the 30 seconds I have, what would that look like?
Yeah, it's really designed to keep people in their homes as much as possible. So no gathering with anyone outside of your household. The order would really reduce capacity at places like stores. K-12 schools would continue at 20% capacity. They're really trying to find a sweet spot where they can keep people from gathering and spreading the virus, but still allow some retail stores to remain open. We don't know when it will go into effect or really exactly what the details will be.
Yeah, so much to watch for there. That's Jackie Fortier, health reporter with KPCC in Los Angeles, California. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Well, let's check in now with North Dakota, where the per capita COVID-19 mortality rate is higher than any other state in the United States. Joining us is Dave Thompson, news director for Prairie Public. And Dave, November so far has been the deadliest month for North Dakota, with still a week to go. What's the situation there?
By far and away, it is the deadliest month. It's almost double what it had been through April through October. We're over 800 deaths, very closely approaching 900 deaths. And in a state the size of North Dakota, which is about 735,000, that is a pretty high death rate.
Absolutely. You know, it took until November 13th for Republican Governor Doug Burgum to issue a mask mandate. Are you seeing compliance with that order?
I am now. When I go around and visit people or visit stores or go to, you know, local restaurants to pick up takeout, I do see just about everybody is masked up now. This is something the business community here had been urging the governor to do because they didn't want to enforce it without the imprimatur of state officials. Now they've got it, and now they feel pretty good about it.
I want to ask you something else. So South Dakota's governor has refused to mandate mask wearing. How does that complicate this mask mandate for people in North Dakota?
It does to a certain extent among a certain group of people. But, of course, given the fact that there's been a lot of publicity about wearing masks and about social distancing, I think people in North Dakota are starting to get it. The governor had been talking about personal responsibility since the pandemic began. But now he realized that he had to have a mandate. He put the mandate in place, and so far, so good.
Hospitals, we're hearing, in the state are getting slammed. What happens if all of the beds are full? Are there contingency plans?
there certainly are contingency plans, and they're on the shelf right now. But given the fact that we're getting close to capacity, they may take the plans off the shelf. They're using one venue in Bismarck and one venue in Fargo, the state's largest city. The Fargo Dome is the venue in Fargo. At Bismarck, they're going to use the University of Mary, and that would be for overflow beds. That would be for normal patients, so they could have more COVID patients in the hospitals.
Oh, wow. Dave Thompson, thank you so much for this update.
You are very welcome.
He's a news director with Prairie Public.
Well, if all goes well, help will be on the way soon. The federal government says 6.4 million doses of a coronavirus vaccine could be shipped out to all 50 states as soon as it's approved. That means frontline workers could be vaccinated by as early as mid-December. And one issue doctors are talking about now is how to prepare people for the side effects. Earlier this week, a doctor representing the American Medical Association told a CDC advisory panel that patients need to know the effects of the vaccine will not be a walk in the park. Joining us now, Angie Rasmussen. She's a virologist with the Georgetown Center for Global Health Science and Security. Angie, welcome. It sounds like the side effects could be pretty tough here. What do we know so far?
So we actually don't know that much. We haven't actually seen the safety data about the adverse effects of getting the vaccines from the phase three clinical trials for either the Pfizer or Moderna vaccine, or actually for the AstraZeneca vaccine as well. So we don't really know what to prepare people for. And this is one of the dangers in what I'm starting to call science by press release. It doesn't really allow us to take a close look at that safety data and help people understand what they might be in for. The good news is that at least so far, it appears that these vaccines are meeting acceptable profiles for safety in terms of their side effects. The bad news, however, is that based on phase one and two trials, and based on what some folks have been saying about this who have participated in the trials, is that these may have a tougher side effect profile. So no side effects that are unusual for vaccines, but it may be a little tougher for people than just your standard flu shot. They're reporting a higher rate of those side effects.
Well, one of those people is John Yang. He's a PBS journalist who volunteered for the Moderna vaccine trial. Here he is recently on NPR's All Things Considered explaining how the first shot made him feel.
Every muscle and joint in my body ached. I had a fever. I went to bed. I slept about 10 hours.
And that was just after the first shot, because for Moderna and others, there are two. And John Yang said the second one was even worse. A little bit more on how this might compare, you mentioned this briefly, to something like the flu vaccine.
So the flu vaccine is associated with some of those same side effects, but people are getting really the flu-like symptoms he's describing, the myalgia, the headache, the fatigue, the pain at the site of injection, or potentially pain in other sites. That can happen with the flu shot, but most people, I think, I mean, for me anyways, the last flu shot I got in October was pain at the injection site, and it pretty much went away. This is... These vaccines are thought to potentially have a higher rate of those types of complications, which means it's not dangerous for people to take them, but people may need a little extra convincing that it's a good idea to go through that, because the vaccines will actually provide a significant benefit.
This is important. So let's reiterate a point you just said. Just because there is a side effect doesn't necessarily mean the vaccine is unsafe.
That's correct. While these side effects are uncomfortable, they're not going to cause you any long-term harm. Other vaccines do have similar side effects, and probably many of us have experienced those. The benefits of getting the vaccine outweigh, in my opinion, the side effects, but we do need to prepare people for those side effects so that they're not surprised thinking that they got sick from taking the vaccine.
Right, because some doctors say they're concerned that patients will skip the second shot, and others might hear this or learn about the side effects and say, well, they're not even going to bother getting the first one. Are you worried about that, and what's your message to those people?
I'm definitely worried about people being hesitant or outright declining to take the vaccine. Really, long-term control of this pandemic that would allow us to return to our normal lives where we're not wearing masks and socially distancing all the time really does require a lot of people to take those vaccines. So that might be where I'd start, that the point that these vaccines are going to be essential for long-term control of this pandemic. And for that reason, the side effects are worth powering through. But I think it also is really important for the vaccine manufacturers to release all of the data from their clinical trials so that scientists like myself and other folks who are experienced in communicating these trial results to the public can actually know what we should prepare people for.
Well, indeed. I mean, anyone who's going to go to a doctor's office and accept an injection, they have the right to know. And we're not saying don't take it. We're just saying be prepared with information. Angie Rasmussen, a virologist with the Georgetown Center for Global Health Science and Security. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I scream, you scream. Seems we're all screaming about the amount of time we spend on screens these days, especially for kids. They spend an average of 7 to 10 hours in front of a screen every single day, according to the Mayo Clinic. This is especially a hard challenge for parents like Mandy Hammond of Des Moines, Iowa, who before the pandemic was trying to limit her kids' screen time. Mandy joins us now. And Mandy, you have two teens and a 12-year-old, and you and I both have been on this quest to limit screen time. What were you doing to cut down the time before the pandemic, and how difficult has it been now?
Oh, my goodness. It was definitely on my radar before the pandemic, and it was a issue in our home for sure. So the main thing we were doing was we were trying to have our screen-free Sundays. You know, it was much easier, I think, back in those days before the pandemic, because we had school, we had social outings, we had church, things like that, that we were, you know, naturally going to, that we didn't have to be on a screen. So definitely when the pandemic hit, all of that changed.
How much of your children's screen time right now is school versus play?
Oh my goodness, so much of it is school. In our home, especially, we have gotten to a point where there's not a lot of time for leisure screens now, because probably 4 to 6 hours are spent on a screen doing school. And that starts to get very taxing on everybody.
Yeah. You know, there's been quite a bit of research that shows an increase in depression and anxiety in teenagers when they spend a lot of time on screens of all kinds. What has been the mood of your children and their behavior lately?
They were just really down because of their social outlets being taken away. But what we figured out was the social media is what was causing that depression and that anxiety, because they were seeing what their friends might be doing. So we actually pulled back on the social media exposure. You would think it would be the opposite. And I think a lot of parents think it's going to do the opposite, but it actually helped, because what we started doing was getting together as a family and talking more. So we kind of started to make an effort to limit it even more during the pandemic.
You know, though, it's such a tough balance, though, Mandy, right? Because I think we've always known just how important social interaction is for our kids. They need to, to see their friends. I mean, obviously, it's not safe to allow them to hang out with their friends right now. How do you balance screen time, knowing that right now it may be one of the only ways for them to connect with their friends?
I used to think that if they didn't have their social media in front of them, that they would be left out. They would not be able to connect with friends. But we have found that to actually not be as true as I thought it was. And so what we've allowed is a lot of FaceTiming. You know, we have apps like Marco Polo, texting, obviously, but FaceTime's been a huge one. So they can still actually have real conversations with their friends. And it's not the same as being in person, but at least it is something. And it definitely fills their friendship tank, you know, when they can't be together in person.
Yeah. I mentioned you have a 12-year-old and two teenagers, and you have with you there your 15-year-old daughter, Lydia. Can I speak to her?
Yes, absolutely.
Hi.
Hey, Lydia. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I am well. Thank you for taking the time to talk with us. How are you adjusting to virtual learning and spending so much time of your day on the computer?
I mean, there's always pros and cons. I love that I can get my schoolwork done and pursue things that I want to do. But then there's always the con of it, of not having much of a social life when it comes to like other kids your age. I mean, I go to church and stuff, so that's how I get my social outlet. But it's really kind of sad to not be in that school environment. I mean, personally, I like online learning a little bit better than like real school, because I can just get it over with.
Oh, really? You can just plow through the assignments?
For sure.
How do you feel about your parents' rules about screen time these days?
At the beginning, for sure, I was kind of annoyed with it. But my testimony is the fact that social media was giving me extreme anxiety, where I couldn't leave the house. And I was really dealing with mental health issues. And when they took that away and we had a conversation about it and we decided, like, hey, let's do this together, I really saw improvement. I'm more confident. So, I mean, a lot of times people are like, kind of what my mom was saying is like, you know, if they don't have social media, they don't have a social life. But that is the biggest myth I have ever heard. I mean, I could just see it in my friends, the light go from their eyes because all they have is their screen. And so without having that, I've learned to talk to people and have real connection, real relationships. And I just really think it's great.
You know, this is a really interesting point that you're making, because I'm guessing even with your friends, it might not be obvious to their parents just how much they're going through by being on social media, maybe a depressive state, maybe they're feeling anxious, and they're not going to necessarily tell their parents, I'm feeling anxious and it's because I'm on Instagram or another social media platform.
Right. I think a lot of times it's not always the parents' fault, but it's not always the kids' fault either. It's having to do with this app that's designed to make you addicted. And so what parents and children are dealing with is the constant outside voice of social media dividing them. And I mean, that was happening with me and my parents. You know, I would get in fights about what I was seeing on Instagram. Like, it's fine. So-and-so on Instagram says it's fine. But, you know, my parents couldn't teach me how to live my life. And I think a lot of times, especially these days, parents just don't know how to parent because they have all of these outside voices on social media telling their kids how to live. And then that doesn't make the kids want to listen to their parents anymore because that's all they're hearing is from social media. I don't know if that makes any sense, but you know.
Oh, it makes that's just complete what I've been sense, seeing. Lydia. Yeah. What advice would you have for other teens and younger people in the predicament just like you? School, at home, and they may have a cell phone too.
It's okay to have a social life outside of your phone. It's also okay to take a break from it. If you feel that your mental health is declining and you don't know why, just try a week without it and see how it goes.
Lydia, you're so wise. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Can I have your mom back?
Yeah. You can tell she's passionate about it.
Oh, Mandy, you've got to be really proud, huh?
I am. I'm sitting here beaming because she's just come a long way in the last 9 months. All my kids, I'm so proud of all of them. They've really adapted well.
You making that note, they've come a long way in the last 9 months. I mean, a lot of parents might hear that and feel like, oh, wow, there is hope for us, because for many of us, we feel like it's actually gotten worse in the last 9 months because of this pandemic.
Yep, for sure. And I hope to be a light to parents. You know, in my involvement with the organization Screen Strong happened 9 months ago. It's kind of when I found them. And what I realized was there was this organization out there that was actually speaking to the issues I was having with my kids and screens. I guarantee you, had we not kind of pulled in the reins on screens when the pandemic started, we'd be in a worse spot for sure.
And we'll have all that information about programs like Screen Strong, which is a site and a program for families managing media and screen addiction, as well as several other resources. Mandy, thank you so much for talking with us. Thank you to Lydia as well for sharing your story.
Of course. Thank you so much for having us.
Our next guest has perhaps a more nuanced approach for parents who want to manage their kids' screen time. Michael Robb is Senior Director of Research at Common Sense Media, and he joins us now. Hey, Michael.
Hi, great to be here.
So we heard from parent Mandy, who told us how well her method of limiting her screen time has worked for her kids. However, you advise parents to not necessarily focus on how much time their kids spend in front of the screen and instead something else. Explain.
Yeah, I think for a while now, media researchers have really been advocating for a shift from thinking about screen quantity to more about quality. In other words, if kids are engaged with high quality content that is kind of fueling their imagination and their creativity, you know, who's to say that should end just because they've hit some kind of arbitrary screen limit? We also place a lot more emphasis on the context of media use. That is, it's not just how much kids are watching, but also, you know, are parents or other people watching with them, talking to kids about what they're seeing and hearing, and extending, you know, what they see on the screen out into the real world.
That makes sense. So, for instance, you know, a lot of school districts have these online libraries now for younger children to read books on. There is a difference of having your child spend time on those type of platforms versus, say, a social media platform.
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, one of the things that is increasingly clear is that screen time is not equal. And we shouldn't act as though an hour of being on an online library through your school is the same as an hour of Zooming with your family, which is the same as an hour of a kid playing Fortnite, which is the same as an hour of watching, you know, Peppa Pig, right? These are all totally different kinds of experiences that are satisfying different needs for different kids at different times.
You say what many experts say, nothing can replace in-person interaction for your children, but using tech to strengthen relationships is more important than ever. What are some ways that kids can make meaningful social interactions and memories through tech?
So especially right now when schools around the country are, you know, beginning to close again, sometimes online interactions are what they have in order to be able to connect with their friends. And we shouldn't diminish the fact that those relationships and interactions they have with their friends online are real to them. And I don't want to imply that, you know, social media should be replacing in-person interactions. But if we know that, you know, kids and teens are getting enough sleep and getting healthy nutrition and doing their schoolwork, being active, and all the things that we know from 100 years of child development research are good for kids, then we shouldn't worry ourselves too much if they also want to be spending time talking to their friends on social media. But I think it is important to leave open a line of communication between parents and kids so that if kids are experiencing things that are questionable or, you know, make them sad or depressed on social media, that they can feel comfortable coming to a parent or to, you know, another caregiver or supporter to offer them help when they need it.
Michael Robb is a senior director of research at Common Sense Media. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Support for Here and Now and the following message is brought to you by the New England Innovation Academy, an innovative engine for students in grades 6 through 12, the first middle and high school that prepares innovators to shape the world through human-centered design. Part world school, part incubator, teaching the cultural dexterity and global focus this era demands. To learn more, visit neiacademy.org.
Across the country, hunting popularity had been declining for years, but not anymore. Take Vermont, where demand for hunting licenses is up significantly, a trend other states are noting as well during this pandemic. Vermont Public Radio's Nina Keck reports.
This is the time of year when you'll see orange-vested hunters out in the woods. Or maybe you'll just notice their empty pickup trucks alongside the road. Lewis Porter, the state's commissioner of Fish and Wildlife, says this year even more hunters will be out and about, as sales of licenses have jumped 20%.
Unfortunately, a lot of people are out of work or working less hours, and that gives them more time. And we know that hunting and angling are things that people love and are important to them, but they're also time-consuming activities. And so with additional time, people are engaging those activities more.
And it's not just Vermont. Nevada has also seen hunting license sales jump nearly 20%. And Mark Laddie, a spokesperson for Maine's Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife, says he's seen increases too.
The number of women hunters coming in are much higher than last year. After having very stagnant or slowly declining hunting numbers overall, all of a sudden, you know, we're seeing close to a 9% increase.
Time in the forest is definitely something Chittenden, Vermont resident Roger Hill loves about hunting, which he says he learned from his father. Hill says he looks forward to the camaraderie forged each November at deer camp.
Deer camp is not just about the hunting experience. It's about gathering with family and friends when possible, and telling stories, reliving memories, sharing laughs, sharing sorrows, and hopefully some hunting success along the way, but that's just the icing on the cake if that happens.
But this year, deer camp is different for Hill and other hunters impacted by travel restrictions and quarantine requirements.
We want to be very careful because Vermont has done a great job of keeping the virus pretty much at bay. So where it really plays an impact is you're not able to have some of the more distant relatives or friends and other members of your hunting community stop by and share a drink or share a laugh or admire a buck that might be hanging from a game pole.
Hill says he's hunting only with immediate family this year. That's what the Vermont Department of Health is recommending. Commissioner Mark Levine says hunters who go to deer camp with people beyond their immediate family worry him. And he said a recent spike in cases in central Vermont is why.
We have well-documented dinner parties, baby showers, people in the high single numbers at a deer camp, The story goes on and on. Opportunities for people to gather together from different households in very modest-sized circumstances.
Vermont Fish and Wildlife Commissioner Lewis Porter says he's heard from many hunters who are taking steps to minimize exposure by alternating weeks at a deer camp or staying in tents instead of sharing a cabin.
A major change for the department also is that we are allowing online check-in of deer for the first time that I know of.
Typically, hunters need to register deer they kill at a state-sanctioned reporting station. Those are still open, but Porter says they've seen a lot less traffic because of the online option, part of the state's efforts to keep hunting safe during the pandemic. For Here and Now, I'm Nina Keck in Chittenden, Vermont.
You might be finding it difficult to muster much gratitude in these difficult times when families are far apart and millions of us are grieving. But maybe we can find some hope in two people from Oklahoma. Aaliyah Shimi is executive director of the Tulsa Metropolitan Ministry and Interfaith Coalition. She is a Muslim. And Aaliyah, welcome to Here Now.
Very nice to speak with you. Thank you for having us.
Sure. And Rabbi Abby Jacobson leads the Emmanuel Synagogue in Oklahoma City. She is president of the Interfaith Alliance of Oklahoma. Welcome to you.
Thanks for having us.
And one of the reasons that this has been such a tough year is that people need community. And I know that both of you have been publicly urging your communities to worship virtually and not in person because of COVID. So Aaliyah, how are you navigating that? Because for so many people, it's just not the same.
I mean, especially within my faith tradition, right? Our worship is supposed to be standing shoulder to shoulder, side to side, and in a very physical prayer, right? That's what our services look like as Muslims every Friday. And so for the safety of our community, we have to be flexible. And what I say to others is, God understands. You know, religion is not there to be rigid, to put you in a box. It's there as a way of life. And, you know, there's flexibility to be able to help with the times with everything that we're dealing with.
Rabbi, how are you handling that with your community, with people who are just so tired of this pandemic, so tired for having to do everything remote and not in person in community with others, especially during a worship service?
We have been fully virtual since March, and it means that we've had to do Passover, a tremendously communal holiday of meals in homes together with family on Zoom. And I can't pretend that this is okay, and I can't pretend that it's the same. And all I can say to them is, yeah, it's terrible. I agree with you. I hate praying at my computer screen, and I can't wait until we can all be back together again. And obviously that doesn't mean that the best choice right now is to go back in person, which would be a dangerous choice and which would be, you know, winning a battle to lose a war. At the same time, and I am not naturally disposed to sunny optimism. I tend to be more Eeyore and less Winnie the Pooh. But it also occurs to me, because I'm trying so hard not to waste this year of my life and my children's lives by just lamenting every day that it's terrible, how much would I have paid a year ago to have people clamoring to get in our doors? Where a year ago, most houses of worship were worried about filling them.
Well, when I hear you talk, Rabbi, it just makes me think that maybe what we're talking about here is limiting or changing our understanding of what it means to be grateful.
I feel, just as a religious Jewish person, I feel that my life is a gift from God. And as just a person, it would be a terrible shame to waste any resource. I save water, I don't use plastic straws, I turn lights off when I'm not in the room. Why would I waste my own time? And if all that means is deciding to take a minute and look at anything positive I have, it's worth the effort.
Aaliyah, on the issue of gratitude, bear with me for just a minute here, if you will. I spoke recently with the actor Michael J. Fox. I know there's a point to this. This is a guy who's known for his optimism. even as he struggled with despair in recent years. He told me that the way that he pulled himself out of darkness through health crises is through gratitude, that it was gratitude that saved him and pulled him up. I wonder what you think about that.
Well, I mean, prior to COVID hitting the United States, last August, I was diagnosed with late stage cancer. And trying to navigate that journey, and I gave myself a couple of days with my family, and I said, we're going to take these couple of days, and we're going to grieve, and we're going to put a plan in place. And then I need everybody to be hopeful around me if I'm going to beat this thing. And the more I looked at it through my journey, my interfaith family, as I called them, every single time I went for treatment, I had rabbis, shaman, preachers, priests, imams. I had people from different communities who just surprised me while I was going through my 5.5 hour treatments, who would come and sit with me and pray with me. And yes, it was upsetting that I was diagnosed with cancer, but you know what? It brought me closer together with my larger interfaith family. It brought me closer together with my community. And so seeing that silver lining in that, and just knowing that the people around me at St. Francis while I was being treated, they were just in disbelief when they saw priests and rabbis coming in to pray for me. And that struck up conversations with other cancer patients around me. What's going on, right? As I'm speaking to you now, I have my father who I just brought home from the hospital, and he is in the next room with hospice nurses taking care of him at the end of his life journey. So just being grateful that we have those healthcare workers who were able to have him pass here under his terms with his family surrounding him, you know, just knowing that even though we are all going through situations, we are all going, you know, we are all depressed, we are all upset, we are all trying to make, you know, heads or tails of this situation, we have to give ourselves the time to grieve and to be upset. But I can't just do that. I have 5 children that I also have to take care of, and I have to take care of my mother, and I have, you know, I have several other responsibilities I have. Just last week, 3 separate people I know lost loved ones because of COVID. One lost a husband, one lost a mother-in-law, and one lost a brother, right? You know, and just like Rabbi Abbey said, I can't pretend that it's okay. It's not okay. None of this is okay. But we are going to get through it one way or another. And if we listen to the science, if we listen to the advice of those who are the people who know how to deal with this better than us, maybe we might be okay on the other end of this, right? Maybe we'll get through this somehow.
Before I let you both go, I want to give you a chance to go out on an optimistic note, because this is what you're getting at right now. This is exactly the point you're trying to make. As you sit down at your table this week and you sit amongst the family and the friends that you are able to see in person, because maybe they're in your pod, what will you tell them is making you happy these days? Rabbi, start with you.
As a rabbi, I get to focus more on being there for people, reaching out to them, and teaching. And those are the things that got me into the rabbinate in the first place. And as a parent and a wife and a daughter, I get to spend less time driving between appointments and more time with my family. And that has been gold. And I would not have wished for it at the price that it's come at the price of so many lives and so much sadness and isolation for people. And in Oklahoma, when someone gives you a compliment that you might not agree with, people say, I'll take it. So I wouldn't have asked for it. The cost is not worth it, but it is a good thing coming out of a bad thing, and I'll take it.
Leah, what's making you happy?
Just hearing the successes, knowing that, you know, our friends in the medical field, I mean, just seeing the burnout that they're going through. And like I said, I just came home from the hospital, bringing my father home,
and delivering him into his room to hospice, and just being able to say thank you to each and every medical worker at the hospital, from the doctors to the nurses to the janitors that were cleaning the room. You know, those are the things that were making me happy, even though I'm incredibly sad with the situation that I'm in. So, just being grateful.
Aaliyah Shimi, Executive Director of the Tulsa Metropolitan Ministry, and Rabbi Abby Jacobson, President of the Interfaith Alliance of Oklahoma. Thank you both so much. Wishing you both health and happiness in the year ahead.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us. Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving.
On a recent sunny morning, Kim Wolf and her team are busy digging holes. She's a volunteer at Crossroads Mission, a homeless shelter in Yuma, Arizona, just a few miles from the U.S.-Mexico border. She's working with clients at the shelter to plant a row of Thai basil and calendula, a type of edible flower.
So we're going to, you know, dig the hole and plant them today and get them started and see. We even have hummingbirds.
Oh, nice. Look at that. The mission has over 200 beds for men, women, and children, and it's a refuge for anyone who needs a little help. As I make my way across the open-air campus, I meet a man named Horencio, who arrived at the mission today.
I have a car, so I'm able to travel. I came from northern Illinois because I want to escape the cold and snow. I came to Yuma.
Horencio mostly lives in his car and moves from place to place depending on the weather. During the pandemic, he's been able to stay healthy, but he says his daily routines have become difficult.
You know, the libraries have a lot of restrictions, you know. The library is typically where I get my electricity and water.
Before the pandemic, more than 500,000 Americans were unsheltered, and the virus has left them with even fewer resources. Greg Culver is director of the men's shelter.
You know, we're one of the only places that has stayed open as much as possible through this whole thing, because that's what we're here for. We're here to help in any way we can. So, you know, whether it be food, clothing, and for a while we had portable showers coming in so people could shower and get cleaned up and whatnot, so... We're doing everything we can to just, you know, handle it the best we can and make the best out of a terrible situation.
The shelter received $200,000 in federal emergency money, but its community affairs director, Barbara Rochester, is still worried.
The churches and the nonprofits that always did fundraisings over the last year, and they donate to us nonprofits, well, they haven't done fundraising, so there's no money out there to assist us doing the things that we really need, laundry soap. We need everything. How many loads of soap laundries do we do a day? 50?
Between 50 and 75, easy.
Do you sense financial problems ahead for your organization?
We have been struggling, yes. We're worried about it like everybody else is, but we're faith-based here, so we do a lot of praying here to make sure that we just think and pray and hope and work towards what we can do to get more things accomplished here.
The virus itself presents a more immediate challenge. Greg Culver says the shelter had to shut down a few weeks ago when 8 people tested positive for COVID-19, and they've just recently reopened.
We're integrating new rules for the homeless to come in. We have quarantine rooms, so we have them COVID tested, and we have them stay in the room until we get their results back. If they're a negative, we'll transfer them over to the guest side where we begin our homeless process. We're getting them their IDs, helping them get housing, employment, whatnot. And if they are positive, we keep them in quarantine for 14 days and then retest them when they come out. And then we start the process of what we can do to help meet their needs.
Right now, the mission's main goal is to get as many people sheltered as possible before Thanksgiving. For years, they've hosted a 3-day holiday meal that brings volunteers from across the country to serve 3,000 dinners. This year, it will be different.
We're only going to be serving on Thanksgiving Day and Christmas Day, and it's only going to be for the frail, elderly, and mentally ill that we will be delivering home-delivered meals to. We also will be providing meals to go for our homeless. So we're looking at delivering 500 meals each day.
How are you feeling about that?
It's very... it hurts a lot. It's very distressful. That's why we're here for, is to help people over the holidays, to help with depression and suicide. So we're really keeping an eye on our frail elderly that absolutely have nobody to share the holidays with, and their families can't come down. So it's really hard on us here at the mission.
So as we head towards the end of this really sort of just awful year, 2020, what are your hopes for the holiday season?
I hope that we could just open up and be normal again. Normal is like the way things used to be, where all of us agencies were able to work together and help all these individuals who really need us. They're destitute. You know, when you live on Social Security, you make $700 a month. You know, nothing can go wrong in your life because you won't have the money. So we're always there to say, listen, I know who can help you. Let's take care of this. So we take care of each other's clients, client by client.
It's interesting to hear you say, go back to normal, because for the people that you serve, normal is still pretty darn tough.
Yes. Yes, it is. It's tough.
Tomorrow, Crossroads Mission will try to make it just a little bit easier. They'll wake up on Thanksgiving morning and set out across Yuma, serving a hot meal for the holiday to the people who need it most. And I want to thank Christina Kim for producing and writing this story, even though she couldn't be at the border with me because of COVID. I'm also grateful to Eileen Balinski and Chris Ballman, two of our editors, who make us sound better every day. This show could not happen without all the people behind the scenes, so thank you to every single one of them. Here and Now is a production of our staff at WBUR and the journalists of NPR and the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now.